All right. Good morning, everyone. It's June 13th, 2025, 9 o'clock a.m. I'm Phil Albert, hearing examiner for Kitsap County, holding what I hope is the last day of the Silverview appeals. This is file number 2300913 and 202979. We are down to just one witness, Mr. McCormick, I believe, on behalf of the applicants. And after that, we're going to go into closing. I think the order will be, unless there's any objections, would be county, then applicant, then appellant. Is that I think that's about right. We have some different burdens of proof on different issues, but overall, it seems to fit the format best. So, with that, Mr. Schultz, I think you had Mr. McCormick up for.
So, Mr. Examiner, in the interest of time and to not repeat testimony, we've decided not to call Mr. McCormick a second time, and we're ready to proceed right to closings if that's okay with the
Okay,
examiner.
let's do that then, unless someone else had something before we jump into it. All right, we'll let Mr. Wachter jump into it then. And Mr. Wachter, I know that you kind of came in this mid-stride, and it's been probably a bit of a challenge to catch up on all this stuff. I appreciate how you've helped out so far. So go ahead.
You're muted, Mr. Wachter.
There I am.
Yeah, there.
Well, good morning, all. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
I appreciate your remarks, Mr. Examiner. And I guess from the county's standpoint, I don't know that I have 20 minutes of content to share with you in terms of closing remarks, but I would like to offer a few comments that would hopefully set the stage for our kind of the overall closing process, as well as for your consideration. My I guess this is a remand where there's a great deal of work that's already been done. I'm aware that in the previous proceedings, there was at least 4 days of testimony regarding the wetland issues. And I think it's important to bear in mind that the rulings thus far really put left us with some two fairly narrow subjects. The subject of peer review soil testing is, I submit to the narrowest of the topics because the scope of what was requested was actually it was quite limited. The examiner requested and required additional test pits to be dug to potentially establish sufficient substantial evidence to support the applicant's delineation of citing to the remand at page 5. And that is, of course, despite Dr. Cook's contrary findings. The examiner requested and required at minimum two test pits in the southwest corner. One approximately midway between D9 and the south property line, and one 25 to 50 feet east of the first pit, citing to page 14 of the remand. And I believe that the examiner requested that there be evidence to support the use of the routine method as opposed to the comprehensive method of this collection. This is in light of again, the substantial amount of testimony and evidence that was proffered in the previous hearings. From the county's perspective, the applicant has satisfied its requirement to conduct the additional testing to, again, provide substantial evidence to support the applicant's delineation. Substantial evidence is, of course, that quantum of evidence that's necessary to support a reasonable fact finder's reasonable conclusions under the circumstances. This evidence came to you in the form of a multiple witnesses' testimony to establish that, in fact, that level of testing was conducted and that it is sufficient to provide that substantial evidence. I think that, in all my years as a trial attorney, I've seen a lot of expert witnesses in everything from aggravated murder cases and to cases involving shooting ranges. And I've never seen anything quite like Dr. Cook. Dr. Cook is adamant in her position, and she was frankly defensive. From the very beginning of her testimony, she talked about how she was going to be giving, or how she felt like she had to reestablish her qualifications to testify as an expert in the area of wetlands. And of course, I'm not privy to everything that was said or possibly implied about her qualifications, but the county isn't here to testify or to challenge her fundamental qualifications to provide testimony. But what I am here to challenge is that she chose a narrative or chose an outcome or an opinion, I guess opinion's the best word, and was absolutely adamant about it, inflexible about it, and it was simply going to be her way or no way at all. And I think that when a witness essentially speechifies rather than testifies, that should cause us to have a little bit of skepticism as to their overall opinions. Dr. Cook, again, eminently qualified, particularly in the subject of wetland plant species, it simply wasn't credible as to the ultimate conclusions and her ultimate findings. The county is of the opinion that the applicant dug test pits that were close enough to and representative of Dr. Cook's test pits so as to lead or to provide what the remand required. I would submit that the peer-reviewed testing was also appropriate and satisfied any requirement that had been set forth for that testing. I think it was particularly important that Radke's sampling was down gradient and was done in a way so as to ensure that it was representative. And so indeed, in 5 out of the 6 test pits that were dug by Radke, it was found not to contain hydric soils under the appropriate standard that is now recognized and applied in the state of Washington. I would like to, I know that Mr. Schutz will elaborate upon that, and I will be the first to acknowledge that he has some further experience in wetland delineations than myself. And so, but I offer it in terms of, was the remand satisfied? I would say yes, and possibly abundantly so. The other issue, of course, is this question of feasibility. And in the final decision, the examiner found that structured parking is necessary absent a demonstration of infeasibility. It may be that the county gave some, didn't give all of the consideration to this issue that it might have in its previous treatment of this issue. I think it was by agreement of the parties that this remand could occur and avoid the issue unauthorized additional hearings. And it was decreed that the applicant could present new evidence on this question of feasibility under the SDS 9.4.3D at a remand hearing. It is clear that the applicant holds the burden of proof to present substantial evidence demonstrating infeasibility of understructure parking, and that's in citing to the remand at page 6. So I hearken back to a previous decision of the hearing examiner. It was in paragraph 12 of the hearing examiner, in the notice of hearing examiner decision, the examiner recognized that there is an artesian aquifer, spring fed, so it's subject to constant upward pressure. And the examiner wrote that if a backhoe punctured it during construction, this could affect project constructability and worker safety. There is, of course, once a puncture is, if one is closed, if there's a puncture and it's closed, then there's a risk of permanent upwelling. And so that creates a grave concern that could potentially support a finding of infeasibility. I think it's significant that how the pendulum has swung here. In the previous hearings, the appellants presented hydrogeological testimony that they had seen this happen on project sites in which there had been punctures and of an aquifer's cover. And the hearing examiner cited specifically to hydrogeologist Matthau's testimony that he had seen this happen on project sites before and cited examples. So it's now where the appellant had previously been concerned about this issue. Now it is the applicant that is voicing the concern about this issue. And the appellants went to some lengths to try to explain how a building could be constructed without endangering the aquifer. I thought that testimony on this issue was really quite interesting from the counties. I have the luxury of being able to kind of hear both sides of it. And what I heard is on one side testimony as to all the reasons why understructure parking would require additional foundations and additional excavation. And then of course, from the other side, why understructure parking could be accommodated without such additional excavation. And I think that the truth, as usual, lies somewhere in between. I think it's the evidence on balance is that understructure parking would require additional excavation. The only question is how much. And that part may be a little bit murky. I hope that Mr. Schutz can address it in citing his expert's testimony. Because the concern remains that that we must protect this aquifer. However, whatever happens, that seems to be foundational. No pun intended. Because if we don't protect the aquifer, then this project site becomes compromised and we end up with a problem that affects it as well as neighboring properties. That should bear on the feasibility question. Feasibility is also presented to us from the standpoint of project, frankly, the cost to construct the project, to complete the project. I fear that we heard apples and oranges types of testimony. On one hand, the applicant's engineer, McCormick, testified that the creation or the construction of understructured parking would cost between $60,000 and $70,000 per parking space in additional costs. On the other hand, we heard from the appellant's architect who testified that the cost, I believe he agreed that the cost to create understructure parking would be $30,000. I didn't hear him explain how that was $30,000 beyond what it would cost to construct surface parking. I think that's a little bit concerning, because that's not apples to apples exactly. What's clear is that understructure parking has additional costs, and it is fair to require some showing of the issue of project costs with respect to the issue of feasibility. In a perfect world, we would have seen pro formas that really lay it out to explain why, in fact, on this project, the costs are so exorbitant as to bear on feasibility. It's the county's view that even if the evidence is inconclusive on the issue of additional project costs to create understructure parking, it's the question of the aquifer that cinches this. And I believe that the applicants have met their burden to demonstrate that there is a substantial risk of compromising the aquifer if they are required to do understructure parking. Certainly the circumstance of a two-story parking understructure parking garage, it raises the stakes that much further. With each story, obviously there have to be beams and support to support what is the weight of the structure above it and to comply with all the seismic requirements. But here, there's no universe where a two-story structure would make sense. And I submit that even a one-story structure raises the stakes and raises the concerns. And it hasn't been shown from an engineering standpoint. I don't believe that the appellants have presented evidence to effectively rebut the engineering testimony and the geotechnical testimony of the applicants' experts with respect to this concern. And therefore, I would posit that on behalf of the county, that the applicants have met their burden of proof to demonstrate infeasibility of the understructure parking. It may be a close call from an evidentiary standpoint, but ultimately, the hearing examiner looks at this from a preponderance of the evidence standpoint, and on balance, the evidence demonstrates the infeasibility of understructure parking. So those are my comments. I look forward to hearing those of my colleagues, because they have had the benefit of living with this case much longer. And I stand ready to answer any follow-up questions that the Mr. Examiner that you may have. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Walker. I do have a few. I think as you get into some of these big controversial Kitsap County projects, you're gonna see that one issue that the county has just been hitting a wall and over again is the issue of what's feasible or its close cousin, you know, what's minimum reasonable use. And that's not just for Kitsap County. I think that's, I see that in all my 35 clients. And, you know, the problem with it, and it was raised by, I think, a lot of applicant witnesses, is that's kind of a, you know, it's a vague concept. And so, you know, that kind of implicates the seminal void for vagueness cases, Aqua versus, I can't remember what the other party was, Anderson. It's Anderson v. Issaquah, where the court basically ruled, and I may be badly paraphrasing, but essentially a statute is void for vagueness if reasonable minds can, you know, disagree as to its application. And, you know, and so in a case like this, you know, when it comes to development restrictions, you don't have to worry about project opponents raising void for vagueness because the remedy is voiding the statute, which is essentially shooting themselves in the foot if they prevail. You have to worry about the applicant. And so I guess the way that I often deal with it is, well, it has to be a really clear, you know, if I'm going to impose something under a vague statute, the evidence has to be clear and reasonably undebatable that it applies. I mean, what do you think about that from the county standpoint? Because I think in practice, that's really what's been done across the board, especially in minimum reasonable use. But I think if you've seen the Spring Hill case where it dealt with, you know, avoidance as mitigation, that essentially is the argument for avoidance is it's not feasible to do this. That's why we're going to mitigate instead of avoiding the impact. And of course, in variance decisions all the time, you need to establish minimum reasonable use. Stormwater regulation, same thing. Infiltration trenches are required to the extent feasible. I mean, how do you deal with such a, you know, how do you apply in practice such a vague standard?
I fear I'm going to give you a vague answer, but I'll try. First of all, I can't really speak to the Spring Hill matter. I'm still wrapping my brain around it. And now the county's been sued not once, but twice already on it. That is all recent. So what I can say is that if we tried to make feasibility extremely specific, there's a risk in that as well. And I say that because one has to consider feasibility on a site by site basis. This, what's infeasible on the subject property here, may very well be feasible on an abutting property uphill of it. And it may very well be that these groundwater conditions here don't, you know, are not representative of what's throughout the area, and that they are in fact unique to this site. I think that it becomes a tougher question on the issue of cost. And I think that, you know, counties are going to have to grapple with this as we try to apply a standard of feasibility. I appreciate why you as an examiner are looking for really clear evidence to make your decisions on this. I submit that that's ideal, but not necessarily what we get in this type of a dispute. You know, what's clear is that in this case, what's clear is there's through the whole process, this has been a concern, that meaning the vulnerability of this aquifer to penetration. And I think that that's there. If there's a prime directive in this, it's we got to protect the resource, and that's why the county comes down on this. I submit that there's clear evidence that concern has been with us throughout it, and that this is that we have to view feasibility from the standpoint of protecting that resource. I don't know how much more I can say regarding your question. It's the right question, and I think you probably have to. It sounds like you grapple with it routinely.
Yes, exactly. Then the other question was, I believe it was your witness, Mr. Wright. He made those comments about the fact that the Department of Ecology opinion of where the wetland boundaries are located was determinative and we couldn't question it. And you cross-examined Dr. Cook on her opinion that he was wrong on that, which kind of suggested you might have agreed with him on that opinion. Or because I know that in well, actually, yeah, I think it was Spring Hill where the county even said if the Department of Ecology even grants a fill permit, that the county, that the project still has to comply with the city's, or excuse me, the county's critical areas ordinance. So I just kind of wanted to confirm one way or another. I mean, do you agree with Mr. Wright's? I mean, he was pretty adamant that the DOE opinion was essentially preclusive and we couldn't question it at this point.
Well, that's the county's position. We treat the DOE's conclusion as conclusive, as dispositive of the location of the wetland. We contemplated recalling or calling Steve Heacock, but ultimately Mr. Wright gets it right. He made he accurately articulated the state of well, frankly, what is the right finding of the DOE and why it is binding. And frankly, you know, there seems to be all kinds of speculation around the circumstances of that, which we're not here to parse out. We have a defined area of wetland that the Department of Ecology has recognized, and I don't believe that the evidence would support any sort of variance of that. You know, it goes back to what's the scope of the remand? Well, have the pits that have the test pits that were dug met the requirement of the remand, and I submit that they have. That's we might be having a different conversation if the peer review pits were came up with, you know, more than one out of six hits on hydric soil. I don't know what the dividing line would have been. But here, the additional rounds of test pits satisfy the remand and should satisfy you as to, you know, being consistent with your prior conclusions, which if I read the previous decisions correctly, this was more than a, not so much a revisiting of the entire wetland analysis as it was QC. It was quality control to ensure that the applicants hadn't been off base in presenting their previous position that was consistent with the DOE's approved wetland area.
Thanks, Mr. Walker. You made really good points. All right, so let's move on to Mr. Schutz. Ready to go, or is it Mr. Lynn? I'm not sure which one's going to do it today.
It will be me, and I am ready. It's ready to
go. Okay.
I'm going to set my timer so I don't ramble and keep on track. And I apologize in advance. I'm having some allergies, and I've got some coughing and some hoarse voice, so please bear with me. But thank you, Mr. Examiner and parties, for this opportunity, you know, to address the last couple issues in this project that's gone on for a long time. These hearings are tough. They're pretty exhausting. They can be contentious and stressful at times. And I just want to thank everyone and for professionalism shown throughout the hearing. It makes these kind of difficult hearings much more pleasant when everybody is as professional as they have been in this case. So I wanted to say that on the offset. On feasibility, we recognize that it's our burden. That was made clear in the remand order. And so, how we met our burden, our position is that we have done so, and clearly, by providing, a multidisciplinary report, that, as Jeff Smith testified to at the hearing, was likely the most comprehensive that he's seen in his 30 years on feasibility of the city, where the city staff agrees with our analysis, on, on the different issues, and where most of the evidence and testimony supporting the analysis was largely unrebutted. And I'm talking about testimony on the aquifer, testimony on structural foundation impacts, evidence on market rental analysis. All of those were largely unrebutted. And to the extent that there was rebuttal, it was largely from Mr. Adams, who's someone who, as good as he may be in his field, frankly lacks the experience and expertise on the specific areas that are largely at issue on the feasibility side, which, structural engineering, hydrogeology, and experience with building structured parking, complex buildings with structured parking, apartment buildings. I don't think he's done that in the last 15 years, whereas the experts for the applicant have varied and lots of experience in that area. So that's just this kind of setup to say that having submitted, a multidisciplinary analysis on feasibility with independent grounds that was accepted by the county, here the applicant, I'm sorry, the appellants, needed to show, what was wrong with that. I mean, I know it's our burden, but having set all that out and laid it out with reports, with testimony, et cetera, it was on them to come back and show what was wrong, and we don't believe that they did that here. Getting into feasibility a little bit more, I guess I'd like to start with the question that you asked, Mr. Wachter, on how is this used, this sort of potentially vague term, how is it applied? One thing I wanted to touch on was the no reasonable use. That's a more restrictive, a more restrictive standard. That's a bigger burden on us in that test. Feasibility is a broad term. It's pretty open-ended. That's why we submitted evidence on all aspects, on three or four independent, bases. Because all of them are components that come into play with that. It's used throughout the SDS. I think it's used 20 times in that document. And it's clear from that document that it's intended to be more flexible, more of a, does it make practical sense? Does it further the purpose of the restriction, or does it undermine the purpose of the restriction? Because if it undermines the purpose of the restriction, then there's no reason to apply it on a strict basis. I mean, for example, a where feasible requirement to have mixed use with any residential project, which occurs in at least one of the districts, that would make no sense if it was off the beaten path, not near any main roads, not near any foot traffic. Doing so would mean that it'd be really difficult to lease out those ground floor units that are mixed use. So in that case, it would defeat the purpose of the requirement, and that's the sort of flexibility that's baked into those standards. I think it's not unlike other terms like compatible or appropriate transition or respectful of residential neighbors. It's more discretion for staff and their expertise than you'd see in this sort of reasonable use requirement. But be that as it may, whatever the term may mean in a close case, we don't think that this case is close, because of the number of independent bases that we've provided. So I guess I have to get right to those. We mentioned independent grounds. So the first one is hydrology. And as Mr. Wachter mentioned, it's a little bit ironic that, after the last hearing, now that the appellants are here to say how it's acceptable to get a little bit closer to the aquifer, as it's a complete 180-degree change from their position previously. But setting that aside, we have a credible expert hydrogeologists, saying that the foundations should not be any lower at all. And that's not something that he's a professional, his reputation is on the line. He wouldn't, wouldn't make stuff up anyway. But it's not even a question of like, did he come up with that for this litigation? That is 100% consistent with what he testified to at the last hearing, right? So no deeper is his testimony. But it's not just that. He also said that wider is bad, right? For two reasons. One, because the wider the foundation, the more on a slope, the more you're going to cut into the hillside, and therefore you're going to be closer to the aquifer, also dangerous. The other part of the wider is that when you scrape a wider surface of even a small amount, you're creating a area that is more prone to failure because you've opened up a wider base that the pressure is pushing against the till layer over a wider area that is not as strong. So there's two independent reasons why wider is worse. One of which is not even about being deeper. It's just literally about being wider. And then the third thing he said also wasn't really about being deeper. And that was this idea that the longer you leave open an excavation, the more complex the project, the longer you leave it open, the more risks and more danger there is. Because again, you have a reduced till layer that has pressure against it. And so time is ticking and you want to close that up and get a building on top. Structured parking is more complex. Mr. McCormick talked about all of the weight that's involved in that, the millions of pounds of concrete. And then Adam's, proposal of having a wider foundation and then offsetting a building on top of it, your testimony of the complexity of that. And all of that means leaving it open longer and having more risk. And that also is not really about necessarily about deeper. But one other thing that Pyowski said was, about the elevator. He gave us that horror story of an 8-inch, I think, pipe hole or something. A small area deeper is bad. It doesn't matter if the elevator area is going down and the rest of the building, say, is only going down 2 and the elevator is 6, whatever. It's bad. It risks any puncture could be catastrophic. I guess I'm laying that out because it's important because it was an issue at the last hearing, and none of that is rebutted, right? I mean, there was no testimony from the other side that Mr. Pyowski was wrong. And Mr. Pyowski, when asked about, okay, what about, it could be 6 to 12 is the numbers you were given. What about 4? What about 3? Whatever, 2? He said all of that is an unacceptable risk in his mind. So shave off a foot here, shave off a couple inches there. The risk still exists. Mr. Adams testified that you could just go up and not down, but he's not a structural engineer. He's not a hydrogeologist, and he hasn't designed apartments in 15 years. And again, in contrast, the applicant's experts have decades of experience designing apartments, similar buildings with elevators and structured parking, and they regularly priced out costs for these improvements in the course of determining project feasibility. These are the type of people that Mr. Adams would consult on a complex project like this. But he didn't consult any hydrogeologist. He didn't consult a structural engineer, was his testimony. So on these issues, the applicant's experts are more credible because it's their areas of expertise. And they all, and the fact that the county accepted them, that makes it even more credible. And all of them have said that structured parking means bigger, wider, deeper, heavier foundations, and unacceptable risk. And again, maybe you could save an inch here or a foot there through, much effort and thorough design. But the foundational aspects and features that were testified to by Mr. Miller, Mr. McCormick, and Mr. Pyowski, they stand. Whether an elevator is 6 feet down or 4 feet down, really doesn't matter in light of Mr. Pyowski's testimony. Oh, I should say, I almost forgot. I promised to make this clarification. Mr. Paul McCormick, it came up at the hearing that Mr. Paul McCormick was an owner. I think there was just a confusion on a question that Mr. Lynn asked Mr. Adams. I think he asked about Mr. McCormick and the owners. Those are two different. Mr. McCormick is not an owner, has no business interests, is strictly been, you know, a consultant on the project, both as structural engineer and as the owner of the architectural firm that designed the buildings. I just wanted to make that clear that he's not an owner and he doesn't have any financial interest in the project. So we heard from Jeff Smith, you know, and testify that the county looked at this closely. You know, in the remand process, the county asked for additional information and clarification. That's why there was, you know, two feasibility reports submitted and then additional declarations, et cetera. That was in response to the county, you know, looking at this closely. And the county concluded that the analysis is comprehensive and that the design standards are met. And as Mr. Walker said, you know, maybe this was lacking in the last hearing, the record of the last hearing, but the record now clearly supports the county's conclusion on remand. So that's the first issue, is the hydrogeologic issues that are unique to this property. And so moving on then to the second problem, and that's design standard trade-offs. And so even if you were to ignore the dangers posed by, you know, more excavation over this fairly shallow aquifer, you know, Adam's suggestions for alternatives, you know, present the exact kind of aesthetic concerns that were raised by him and his clients during the first hearing, with bigger, bulkier buildings, bigger foundations, and more impacts to neighbors. You know, they're not the buildings that Mr. Miller described as sitting lightly on the property, you know, with the grade. Adam's drawings show garden style apartments on top of structured parking, but that's not how it would be, because as the testimony made clear, you know, that's, you need elevators, and that would widen the buildings. You'd have corridors, you'd have staircases coming down either side for emergency exit, you know, and all of that means a much bigger foundation, much bigger buildings. About, I think the testimony in the report was 150% bigger. And, you know, the examples that Mr. Adams provided, you know, they were all urban dense designs, mixed use projects that he would have criticized before as not being respectful. And now he's providing them as opportunities. And there was a lot of talk about putting some of the parking under the buildings and still having surface parking. So you'd have some under and some surface. But you'd still need elevators, so the buildings would still be bigger, massive, and have more impact. I want to touch briefly, and time is flying, but I want to touch briefly on the rivulet apartments that were, you know, provided as an example. And those really are apples and oranges. And we all saw the pictures that were brought up of the apartments. You know, the way they're designed is that they use the grade to hide the parking under the building. They're long buildings. And then the parking comes in the end, and that's the downgrade side. Yeah, so they're cut into the grade the long way, right? So that the parking is out of sight. But that's the opposite of what could occur on this property. You know, cutting into the grade is exactly what we don't want to do. That's why the buildings are designed as light, narrow ones that go with the grade and not against it, right? This is unique, and rivulet is not comparable. North Beach was also discussed. And again, it's apples and oranges too. But I think it's relevant in one, you know, maybe if we get to the examiner's question on the where feasibility and the vagueness of it, you know, it's relevant as to that language needs to be applied consistently. I mean, that's either it's vague, you know, void for vagueness, or it needs to be applied consistently. And in that district, you know, we looked at the staff report a little bit as a illustrative exhibit and talked about the project. In that district, housing or office units will be mixed with retail uses where feasible. That's the exact language, I believe. And certainly it's possible, you know, to put retail uses on the ground floor of that apartment project. But the idea was that it's not on the arterial. It's not in the center, Buckland Hill Center. It's not walking. It doesn't make sense. It defeats the purpose of providing mixed use. It's not practically doable, right? Because you wouldn't be able to lease it out. And that's the same here. You know, that parking, you know, even if it's even if it was capable, and we believe because aquifer it's not, you know, but even if it was, it defeats the purpose. The purpose of the underbuilding parking is to hide the cars. And the testimony from last hearing made clear that nobody at ground level will be able to see the surface parking due to the extensive screening, which is more than the code requires. And the design alternatives are worse. And more visible and have more visible impacts to neighbors. I mean, the bottom line is that the screen surface parking with parking between the buildings, as Jeff Smith testified to, you know, protects parking from the view of neighbors far better than Adams, you know, design alternatives. And so, in the same way with the Buckland Hill mixed use, where feasible, this would, you know, to defeat the purpose of the requirement in the first place, make it worse. Is makes it not practically doable. Third thing is cost. Cost information was provided by experts, including financial analysis of obtainable rents in the Silverdale area. There was a declaration by Mitchell Belcher that says the project can't be financed with structured parking here. That was unrebutted. That's at B17. You know, Adams attacked the costs, but his WGI report, you know, that parking analysis, which is something he hasn't used and, you know, maybe found by Google, but it's totally different. It's completely different buildings. It's standalone parking and it's not comparable. you know, for parking and elevators, it's as if Mr. Adams just sort of walked his Seattle neighborhood with a camera for sort of what ifs, but those are like trial balloons, you know, and like they're. It's not a deeper site-specific analysis, you know. It's kind of throwing darts, and it doesn't match what was done, the work that was done on the other side, on the applicant side here. And in contrast, the evidence the applicant presented were local on costs, based on site information, based on experience, and substantiated by multiple sources. And it, you know, even if the cost of parking was $4 million, as Adams presented, you know, the rents would not be sustainable. And that doesn't include the additional costs of the bigger buildings and the elevators, et cetera. So to answer, you know, to address the examiner's question about, you know, where would parking, building parking apply if added cost means infeasibility, I think that was raised at the hearing. Being more expensive, I think, in and of itself is not enough, because every project, right, is going to be more expensive with structured parking, every project on every property. But as it's been applied to other projects, you know, feasibility, it means, you know, capable of being accomplished. It means practically doable. And if you take a project out of the market for the rents of the area, you know, then it's not practically doable. It's not capable of being accomplished. This project would not move forward with if there is structured parking under the buildings, even outside of the aquifer issue. You know, maybe that's different for other properties that can charge higher rents, you know, and maybe other properties don't need elevators. And so it would, you know, a different analysis would have to be done for those different properties, but that's not here, you know. And so is it in and of itself that more costs the issue? No, but adding it all together and taking a project, you know, out of the possibility of getting done, especially if the following the strict language of the SDS, you know, defeats the purpose of the requirement, you know, all weighs in favor of infeasibility. And I'm getting down. I've got about a minute or two, so I'll try to go through this last part as quick. But this is the wetland issue. So the last thing I want to talk about is wetlands. This property's been dug and tested to the extreme. You know, Mr. Wright testified that, having been out there with Radke twice, independent reviews, he wondered why we're still talking about this issue. But once again, Mr. Skoll's soil analysis is being challenged by Dr. Cook, who hasn't been on the property for 5 years. Skoll's did a thorough analysis. He didn't rely only on A11. He went out there, looked at all factors. Actually, went out there 3 times, right? And importantly, Mr. Skoll's was the only expert, you know, who actually cited to the manuals, pulled up the manuals, read them, the actual language and the authorities that govern soil analysis, applied them to the data forms that he'd collected, and showed why they were accurate as to the current science and the most recent manuals. And this analysis, his analysis on the manuals and the requirements and how they're applied went essentially unanswered. The location issue, briefly, it seems clear that something is off, something doesn't line up quite right. But the testimony was that the plots that were dug on remand were geo-referenced from Cook's own maps. And you know, Mr. Scholes and Ms. Hyland did their very best with the information that Cook provided to comply with the remand order. But at the end of the day, I really don't think it matters. I mean, ultimately, the applicant followed the remand order, and 20 additional data plots were dug on remand, as compared to 5 total data plots that that Ms. Cook, Dr. Cook, had dug 5 years ago. And you know, on top of that, that's on top of the data plots that were dug before that are in the area that she claims a wetland nobody else has found. It's clear that there's no wetland between her data plots and the 355. Yeah, bottom line is a ton of work's been done since she was out there in 5 years by a ton of qualified, reputable people. And everyone agrees that the 355 wetland is the correct delineation, all except the DP16, which Radke had found. And as our materials show, we've offered to include that in to put this to bed. Mr. Wright said that's a very reasonable thing to do. That's a good compromise to include the one plot that they found. And to be clear, 6 data points were dug all around that afterwards. And we didn't find, you know, Mr. Scholes and Ms. Hyland did not find any wetland. And we went over those forms over and over during the hearing. They're accurate. They're good. No wetland around there was found. But in order to compromise on that one, we've offered this alternative wetland design that would take the wetland from 355 feet to 571 feet. Without compromise, they're really hoping we can move forward on a project that's seen more wetland work than, as people have testified, pretty much any other project of this size. My time's up, so the project's been approved on all issues except these last two. The record is more than sufficient to support moving forward finally. Again, I want to thank everybody for the time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, just one for you, Mr. Schatz. You made the comment that structured parking would drive up rents outside of the market there. What's the evidence in the record to support that kind of finding? Because I don't think you actually had a market analysis or any testimony from a real estate agent. I mean, it's both an engineering question and a real estate marketing question as well.
Yeah. So two things. One is Foundational Exhibit 16. And I'm going to get to page starting at 16, page 11. And that's discussing a market analysis that was done by Mercadia. And it's included exhibit F. That's a rental market analysis. And we provided that and the rental analysis. And the county said, could you please provide, can you provide a little more information on this? That's the declaration of Mitchell Belcher to flesh that out. And that's going to be at Foundational Exhibit 17. So he is a broker, knows this project, worked with the owners, did an analysis, provided his expert opinion on it. That is, it's not, you couldn't get it financed by a bank.
Okay, good. Yeah, glad I asked. Okay, thanks, Mr. Schatz. Very helpful. All right, Mr. Clungeon, you get final word today.
All right. Morning, everyone. So following the hearing, the applicant was instructed to do two things for this remand, to dig and analyze test plots at or near Dr. Cook's plots, and to place parking under the building unless they can demonstrate infeasibility. It's the appellant's position that the testimony over the previous days demonstrates that the applicant did not accomplish either. Regarding the wetland, the data sheets show that Soundview, Terra Science, Radeke, they did not dig test plots in the same location near at or near Dr. Cook's plots. The vegetation is dramatically different. Even the appellant's own experts agreed that the dramatically different vegetation would indicate that the plots were not in the same spot. It was clear that it was different. The types of vegetation identified by Dr. Cook, would persist in that area. When the experts came out and visited in late October, they would have found similar vegetation. Dr. Cook, she's an expert in this vegetation, expert in grasses, sedges, rushes, and established that many of these are kind of mono stands of things like reed canary grass that would not change year after year. Hence, it was clear from all the different data sheets with all the different vegetation that they were not in the same locations. The applicants test or experts did testify that there was some uncertainty about that location, yet they never asked her for those data points. She also, Mr. Schutz mentioned, the 20 data points. Well, Dr. Cook had 23 data points in her delineation. It wasn't, she sampled a number of places. She had all of that data available. She would have been able to share it, but it was never requested. And this is significant because, as Dr. Cook testified, a couple of inches can make a difference in terms of upland versus wetland delineation. If you're testing a couple of feet over, you're testing in the upland. So that does not, it won't show the wetland area that Dr. Cook has identified. Further, some of the plots do have hydric soils and thus meet the parameters for the wetlands. For example, we have in the data sheets at A9, A2, F11, F13, F18 show that wetland vegetation is present throughout the site. Everyone agrees that much of the vegetation is predominantly wetland. Regarding the hydrology was also present at a number of the sites, but it's also acknowledged that it's underrepresented in the data in part due to the time of year. Both Dr. Cook and the applicants, experts testified to that as well. It's su not surprising that some hydrology was missing when they visited in July, as that's not the appropriate time to find those indicators. And Dr. Cook also, discussed that hydrology only needs to be present for a certain length of time within a year, a relatively brief time, in order to establish that parameter. And that's why by Dr. Cook and even the Department of Ecology expert Diane Hennessy recommended piezometers in order to get more accurate data regarding the hydrology of the site. So, this is a simple solution that can and should be implemented in order to obtain more accurate data on the wetland hydrology of the site. Further, for the hydric soils, the data sheets do show that many of these upland data plots do have hydric soils and thus have the parameters for the wetland. The applicant and third-party reviewer did they focused on A11. I believe they testified that they looked at other indicators as well. But in their own reports, there are multiple different hydric soil indicators. The applicant and third-party reviewer erroneously found that only one of many hydric soil indicators. The 2024 field indicator for hydric soil states that, gives you the definition of the A11, and then we also have the definitions for the F6 regarding, soil with a chroma of 2 or less at 12 inches or less from the soil surface with a minimum thickness of 6 inches. That's A10 at PDF 15 or PDF page 15. As Dr. Cook points out, all of her samples where she indicated A11 was present fit this description. A lot of the disagreement on the A11 comes down to the fact that Mr. Scholes and Soundview, they did not consider that the site had been plowed and disturbed. As Dr. Cook explained, these A11 features can be present deeper and or shallower in places where the soil was plowed. Soil gets dumped on top, scraped away, and the chroma of these deeper soils doesn't change with the time, as Mr. Scholes claimed. That is why Dr. Cook recognized those A11 indicators were present. In addition to the A11 multiple plots, she contends that multiple plots, or concluded that multiple plots met the F6 hydric soil indicator outlined in the 2024 manual, where we have soils with a chroma of 1 and a redox of 2%, or a chroma of 2 and a redox concentrations of 5%. That's exhibit A10 at PDF 26. Throughout the data sheets for whether Radke or SoundView or TerraScience, this chroma of 1 and 2 with redox concentrations are present. Although the data sheets claim that the redox concentrations are small percentages, Dr. Cook explained that there are established scientific literature finding that the human eye cannot detect less than 2% redox concentrations. So, in short, if someone detects redox concentrations in a soil sample, at least 2% is present, and a number of those data points would show that there are hydric soils. Dr. Cook's conclusions about the much larger size of the wetland are consistent with the Department of Ecology technical staff, Diane Hennessy and Neil Molstad, who also found a 5,000 plus square foot wetland. The applicant claims that Department of Ecology agreed with that delineation, but that was the decision of a director who did not have technical expertise and went against the findings of his own technical staff. According to Dr. Cook and the DOA technical staff, there's simply a much larger wetland that the applicant than the applicant experts would like you to believe. But if you look in the right places and if you look at the right indicators and consider that the human eye can't detect redox concentrations of less than 2%, there's a much larger wetland. Let's see here. Regarding the southwest corner, Dr. Cook explains that the presence of a wetland in the southwest corner remains an outstanding issue. Dr. Cook explained that they should have sampled along the southern boundary line, yet they sampled north of that boundary line. The experts said they, could not access or didn't, get perhaps permission, but they did not seek permission from the adjacent property owner. As Dr. Cook testified from her observations during her site visit, the southern boundary is a wetland, and the applicant simply did not sample within that wetland and believes that we believe that this remains an outstanding issue. Turning to designs, the Silverdale design standards are pretty clear. We have generally applicable provisions for development in Silverdale that states that existing surface parking will be reduced in area, more parking located under the buildings, as well as in selected parking structures. That's SDS 2.4.2. Specific to the waterfront district, the design standards contain mandatory language. The parking will be under the building where feasible for multi-unit buildings, SDS 4.9.3 sub D. Mr. Adams provided significant testimony regarding the design. He, contrary to, I believe, Mr. Schutz's, he does have experience designing and constructing parking or buildings with parking structures underneath. Might have been a while since it was specifically apartment buildings, but even the applicant's own architect didn't have experience designing garden style apartments. He had experienced doing kind of those double loaded corridors with understructure parking. Both Mr. Adams is qualified to test or to testify regarding construction of buildings with parking underneath. And so the issue here is that, this design really hasn't changed. McCormick and Miller testified that adding parking under the building results in a different project, but that's precisely the point here. The design standards require you to make adjustments to the project to satisfy these mandatory requirements, not keep resubmitting the same problematic design. It may result in a different project that is consistent with the standards. And, while it was not Mr. Adams's task to provide a design for the applicant or redesign the whole project for the applicant. He provided examples of how parking could be accommodated in these buildings. There's exhibits A7, A8. There are various po examples of podiums or other types of buildings. We also saw, we also saw the Rivulet and North Beach. There are options here. Mr. Adams provided design options demonstrating that parking can be accommodated under the building without going deeper and without being much taller. There's been a lot of testimony about going deeper, and threats to the aquifer, but that's not what we've been proposing. We acknowledge that there is an artesian aquifer. We remain concerned about it. But at this point, Mr. Piowski, there's established testimony from the county or from the Mr. Piowski and in the previous proceedings saying that as long as there's 50% of the confining till layer, that they believe that that's an acceptable risk and that they don't think that it poses a threat to the aquifer. We are not suggesting that the building need to go deeper than the previous design. The whole argument that it's this threat to the aquifer, that's not the issue here. We've throughout Mr. Adams's testimony contended that you can go up. In fact, that ends up being more consistent with the design standards, which say to go up. So Mr. Adams explained that yet placing parking under the building does not require it to go deeper than the previous proposals. Yes, the design may change, the height may change, an elevator maybe would be required. But Mr. Adams testified that if additional room is needed for ground floor parking as opposed to the previously proposed ground floor units, simply go up, not down. Mr. Adams also explained that there are, various methods such as post-tension concrete slabs that can be re used to reduce the thickness of floors. There are foundations that can, provide adequate support for the weight. I think this just comes down to needing incentive to design something that fits with the actual design standards. It's not taking the same flawed design and trying to wedge it into the space and make it go deeper. Regarding the exit distance issue, the applicant claims that its garden style design with parking under the building won't comply with the exit distance requirements. That's simply because they're taking advantage of a code exception when they only provide one exit. However, Mr. Adams provided solutions regarding communicating balconies. A more ideal solution would be this double-loaded corridor style apartment that we see in other areas. This is a common style for multi-unit buildings for a reason, and found nearby at comparable apartments like Rivulet and North Beach. Further, that double-loaded corridor style would provide twice as many or more units when you have more units on either side of the corridor. So there are additional advantages to just adjusting the design in order to comply with the design requirements. Regarding the elevator, yes, an elevator would be required. Yes, it's an added cost, but it's a common and desirable amenity in many multi-unit apartment buildings. Does it make the project infeasible? No. Mr. Adams testified that the pit only needs to be a few feet below the bottom of the foundation, could be a relatively small footprint, could be located to minimize digging down, and you can also move the foundation up. It also improves the value and accessibility of a building for the residents that are there. Regarding the cost, Mr. Adams explained that the applicant's 60,000-80,000 per stall cost estimate is over double the average that's specific to Seattle of a cost per stall for structured parking. We've got these large numbers, but the estimates lack any substantive backup data, cost breakdowns that are standard practice when preparing a pro forma on a project like this. There should have been itemized costs as lo along with the offsets or deductions. The applicant's estimate does not consider those reductions of foregone surface parking or costs that are already baked into the project. Will underbuilding parking cost more than surface parking? Probably. Would the authors of the design standards have considered this when they included this mandatory language in this particular standard? Also, yes. The cost of the garage is not a determinative factor in feasibility envisioned by the authors of the design standards. The cost of garages are baked into the cake for multi-unit buildings in this waterfront. Regarding the market and this feasibility analysis, this feasibility language is not intended to make this an optional requirement. The lack of a definition in the design standards does not render it optional. Testimony throughout the hearing demonstrated that parking under the building can be feasible. It may cost more. It may need to go up instead of down. It may be a different style of building. Could be a double loaded corridor like Rivulet and North Beach, but that's the intent and the goal of the design standards for development in this waterfront district. We have these examples. The North Beach apartment, a few lots to the west, is a four-story, 47-unit building with one story of parking under the building, and an additional parking offsite. Although a smaller lot, the density is similar to this proposal. The recently constructed Rivulet apartments across Buckland Hill Road to the north features multiple long two-story apartment buildings with one story of parking under the building, as well as some surface parking. Clearly, it's feasible. It can be done. Banks are willing to fund them. Renters are willing to rent them. The applicant's materials only refer to averages that are across the city. It does not show the range of numbers that went into those averages, or how those numbers differ when there are waterfront views. All of the experts generally agree that, areas with waterfront views, even though it's not technically waterfront on the water, these waterfront views increase the desirability. They increase the rent that you could probably get at a site like this. It's also not a challenging site. It's a very large, very gently sloping site, where all you have to do is not build deep down into the aquifer, and you can construct apartment buildings with parking under the structure. So, let's see, I just want to make sure I don't have to come to there. Okay. In conclusion, it was clear from the county, Mr. Smith's testimony, that the county did not take a critical look at the applicant's feasibility analysis. The only example he could recall of the county challenging a feasibility analysis was when the applicant made a feasibility argument when feasibility was not an element of the approval criteria. There was no where feasible language in that case, like we have here. The county didn't consider that the estimated costs, that there was not adequate information, that there wasn't a breakdown. They didn't consider any offsets that would be incurred if parking is not under the building. Surface parking still costs money. Mr. Adams testified that it can run up to $15,000 per stall. Parking under the building means fewer surface parking spaces. Also, this argument that putting parking under the building will have a greater visual impact than surface parking just does not hold water. The design standards try to move away from that sea of parking around these buildings, right? And that's exactly what we've got here. And putting parking underneath will reduce the visual impact of that parking and remain more consistent with the design standards. Let's see. The counties, did also not consider that some of the costs are simply built into the project. Things like, grading, foundations, waterproofing need to occur regardless of whether that's part of the structured parking. Those figures were not identified or deducted. The design standards don't say feasible for garden style apartments. They don't say feasible for affordable housing in a district which, by its nature of waterfront views, can command higher rents. The design standards contemplated and understood that this requirement would cost more to put parking under the buildings. The experts acknowledge that designs other than garden-style apartments are an option on this site. Indeed, we see multiple examples nearby, and a lot of the other garden style in the area are outside of this waterfront district, probably for reasons like that. The applicant simply doesn't want to redesign this project to satisfy the design standards. Accordingly, the appellants request that the examiner remand the matter with instructions that the applicant design a project with parking under the building. You don't have to go deeper, just have to go up. You just have to redesign the building. And the result of that redesign will likely result in something that's less visual impacts to neighbors, less impacts to surrounding to the adjacent properties, more open space for the residents, more amenities like things like an elevator. There was a lot of discussion about how people wouldn't want to walk upstairs. That's part of why elevators are a very common feature in these large multi-unit apartment buildings. That is what is contemplated by the design standards for multi-unit development in this district. So, if a developer doesn't include part have to include parking under the multi-unit building here because it's an added cost for the cheapest design that they came up with over half a decade ago, it renders this design standard meaningless. Nowhere would bother putting parking under the building, and that was not what was envisioned by the design standard authors. So, thank you.
Well, one of the things I'm going to be looking at really closely as I get to read through these hundreds of pages of transcripts is the applicant's structural engineer opinions that even if you just build up, you're still going to have to dig deeper. I think because you'd have to dig more, and you'd need a broader base, which entails digging, more into the slope, and then also maybe I'd have to confirm that the added weight too would require deeper. I mean, to the extent that there are any structural engineering opinions to that effect, how do I weigh Mr. Adams' opinion against that? Because I think the appellants, your only evidence about those structural issues came from Mr. Adams, who's an architect. So how do you balance
Okay.
those two competing
I mean,
opinions?
Mr. Adams, is not a structural engineer, but frequently works with them and works closely with them designing buildings. Also, a lot of the testimony from the structural engineer, it did not consider just actually going up instead of down. They're talking a lot about if we keep it around the same grade as the previous, there's previous structure. There's no requirement that they have to stay at the same or go down. If it needs to be bigger, it could also go a few feet up. There are solutions here that they can design and implement. They just haven't sat down and done it. And so yeah, their testimony is sort of premised on that the position that they don't need to, they can't put it up, and it's not clear why they did that.
Okay, and then you heard Mr. Wachter answer some of my questions about the preclusive effect of the DOE delineation. I mean, if I do find that if I find that Dr. Cook's delineation is more compelling, am I still bound by the DOE delineation anyway? What's your position on that?
So our position. My position on that, I don't believe the DOE has come out, like none of the testimony indicated that DOE has been on the site recently, I believe. We're talking about this delineation that was done a number of years ago. And it's always been our position that the DOE's decision there is actually in extreme conflict with all of the technical staff who found a much larger wetland. They found this 5,000 square foot wetland, and even some of the technical staff that identified that wetland and then were sort of overturned by their boss who did not have technical expertise, they ended up leaving in protest. We have a pretty contested DOE delineation here, that I think that should raise more questions instead of solidify the applicant's delineation.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, McClutchin. Really good as always. So, yeah, I have a lot. As usual, I have a lot of work with this case. Another big multi-day Kitsap County hearing. As Ms. Jones know, when I first got on board in Kitsap County, I think what about a year and a half ago, there was several cases that were multi-day, all lined up, like planes at an airport. And this is the last one that I have to deal with. So I'm looking forward to getting this resolved and getting my life back a little bit. But it's going to be it's brought some surprises. I think the issue about the preclusive effect of the DOE delineation. I mean, nobody argued that until Mr. Wright brought it up. I've done probably hundreds of appeals on wetland delineations, or at least contested permit hearings on that, and no one ever characterized the DOE delineation as something that was binding on a city or a county. I just recall from my days as city attorney, when we wanted to bolster our case, we would ask DOE to come in and corroborate our findings. We never actually considered that to be something that was a binding determination that we couldn't disagree with. And there's nothing in the county code that says that. So, I mean, that's not going to be an issue unless I agree with Dr. Cook. So, that'll be an interesting one to see if I can find any law out there that addresses it, because I haven't seen it before. So that's a really interesting issue for me. But as I mentioned before, when I was questioning Mr. Wachter, I think Mr. Wachter is sort of the most neutral party here, kind of hit the big issues, and he acknowledges that terms like feasibility are difficult to work with, and it's a tough balancing act, and the county is addressing that issue in several different permit applications, and this is going to be a rough one for this one. But I think the applicant has covered everything they possibly can on it, so I have a lot of information to work with. So, and then finally, I think in terms of Dr. Cook's credibility, I know Mr. Wachter wasn't completely convinced. I mean, I think the strength of her advocacy is just based on that she does so many of these hearings that she's pretty good at what she does in testimony. So I don't hold that against her. And that is why I just, whenever Dr. Cook has brought in, I think most developers noted that they need to bring in the best wetland experts as well. And of course, which just makes my job tougher. And that's why, good peer review is so important in those cases. And I think just, kind of as future advice for the county, when you've got really good expert witnesses lined up on both sides, that's where the peer reviewer comes in and can provide a kind of an expert balancing of that very technical testimony. And unfortunately, the peer review in this case has been limited. The last hearing they didn't provide a written report. In this hearing, they just limited their review to application of the A1. And Chris Wright's obviously very good expert. It would have been nice for him to be able to say, well, these test pits were dug in the right location, and I agree with the ultimate delineation. Instead, all he could say was, well, I wasn't asked to verify that this is a good delineation. So it would have been helpful if he could have provided broader opinions on what was going on. But I think we've studied the wetland issue to death, and hopefully I can make a final determinative resolution on that. So I got my couple of weeks to sift through all of this and get that decision out. And Mr. Schutz is right. Certainly appreciate the civility of everybody. For us, for policy wonks such as myself, this is a great time to be going through all this technical evidence and try to solve the puzzle, figure out which way to go when the attorneys are acting civilly and not offending each other, that kind of stuff. That makes it a much more pleasant experience. So I appreciate that and the expertise and professionalism of everyone. Everyone contributed a lot to this case, and as I said, made my job really tough. So anyway, thank you all for your efforts, and have a great weekend. Well deserved. So we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Pleasure being with you.
Everyone.